Hi, this is Mark Cuniberti. You're about to listen to another edition of our award-winning economic show entitled Money Matters. The information given on this show is obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing but is not guaranteed. This show is pre-recorded at an earlier date, so market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at time of airing, and we will not be taking any listener call-ins. Thanks again for listening. Now enjoy the show.
And welcome to the 254th edition of Money Matters, entitled Today, Decisions, Decisions. Before we begin, remember that discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only and the opinions of the people that I may interview and the authors of any articles I may read. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. 254 Money Matters shows. My, does time fly. Money Matters is about money, as money does matter, and the matters of money affect us all in some way or another. Whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it, it controls our economy, our country, our planet, and in some way or another controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money or lack of it or abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, it's about you. Money Matters is not just all about financial markets. We talk about investing in a community, investing in your body, in your home, in your family. You know, we haven't done anything on investing in your garden, maybe. We'll do that sometime. Got some great shows scheduled in the next couple of months, so stay tuned to Money Matters. You can email questions about the show or get them directly to me by just emailing the local program director at your station. You can also see the opportunities at your station or underwrite your station, whatever you like. It's usually on the website for your community radio station, so check that out for sure. Well, as mentioned 2 weeks ago, and then previously back in November, you know, our portfolios, and they've okayed me to say this, our portfolios were market negative to market neutral through the last part of 2015, all the way through November 2016. In other words, my opinion was the market was going to go flat to nowhere. And then November 9th, the day after Election Day, when the current president was decided that he was going to be the man, we went market neutral to market positive, more market positive. And stayed that way until the last show. About two and a half weeks ago, we went back, as we told you 2 weeks ago, to market negative to market neutral. And so that's where we stand right now. Basically, when we say that, when we go market positive, we are of the opinion that the market will rise. And then when we go market neutral, we are of the opinion that the market will be flat. Market neutral to market negative means neutral to down. Nobody can tell you which way the markets go, but those are my opinion in the portfolios that we do. And so we can tell you that we have been market neutral to negative since 2 weeks on the show that I did previously. So I'm just reiterating what we previously said, and we still maintain that stance. So the Dow, 21,350, down 128. And at the beginning of every show, we also always cover these large numbers. Maybe redundant for those that have heard the show before, but for those that may need a few explanations to grasp the concept, or for those that are just joining us, you tuned into Money Matters on your community radio station. The Dow, which is the most commonly watched index, there are others, the S&P 500, the NASDAQ, the Russell, but the Dow is what, you know, most of the major news media follows. It has 30 stocks in it, the Dow 30. Now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has a lot of stocks in it, but the Dow 30 is just a representative index of those. That decides those things are the 30 most influential stocks at the opinion of those that decide that. So at 21,350, the number above us, the large number above us, 22,000, is what we would call a resistance point. There are many resistance points that technicians look at. And just because the technicians think a certain thing about a resistance point, it doesn't mean it is. Okay, it's just an opinion. It's one of the reasons why when you get a degree in economics, you get a sociology degree and not a Bachelor of Science, because it's about sociology. It's about what people think. I've always said on this show that the market will reflect reality eventually, but its day-to-day movements are only the sum of the beliefs and the perceptions of all the players in it at any given time, like today. So what makes a market go down is there's more sellers than buyers. What makes it goes up is there are more buyers than sellers. So the perception is today that there are more sellers than buyers, and the Dow is down 128 points. At 21,350, as I mentioned, the 22,000 is resistance. It usually has a harder time getting through these larger numbers, but not necessarily. But 21,000 below us is a resistance point. I mean, a support level. There I go again. So the large number above us is a resistance, and the large number below us is a support. Now, some technicians believe that if it breaches 21,000, that's a kind of an indicator that it may go lower. The word may, the key word there. And, of course, that when it approaches 22,000, your market usually doesn't blow up through a number, you know, just blow through it like it's paper. It usually will bounce around there, but not always. Remember, when we talk about usually, it's historical precedent, and past performance, of course, does not guarantee in any way, shape, or form which way the market will go. But the technicians, part of that side of the alley, believe that these large numbers are support or resistance. So the number below us, the number below you, the large number below you, 21,000, is a support level, and 22,000 above us is a resistance level. So we'll see which way the markets are gone. You know, we'll go. I mean, when Trump was elected, I think the markets were running around in the 17,000s. And now they're up, 4,000 points in 21,346. Now realize that the Dow is only these 30 stocks. So you could have a situation with the other indexes like the NASDAQ and the S&P fall, and the Dow could rise and vice versa. They usually move in concert with each other, but not always. So we're watching this at 21,346. So we'll see if the erosion, the slow erosion that we've seen last couple of days, last couple of weeks, will continue, or whether it's just what do they call that? A flash in the frying pan. Never fry bacon naked, right? You know what they say? So I don't know why I threw that in there. What the heck? So you are listening to Money Matters, so we're watching the markets. Our way of saying thank you for listening to community radio station is the Agrata website for Money Matters listeners on any community radio station is moneymanagementradio.com. You can get all the past shows that have been approved for distribution. There's a newsletter there and daily, whenever I decide to do a newsletter, you'll get a newsletter in your mailbox. We don't spam you or anything like that. It's just our way of saying thank you for listening to community radio station. Community radio stations give you so much. And, you know, at specific times, they may come forward and have a pledge drive or a membership drive. And that's the way they raise funds, as well as having underwriters. We are not in a membership drive, but just to make you aware, that's how these things work. And so our way of saying thank you is not only giving you the broadcasting and disseminating the material and the music, the great music that you hear on all your community radio stations in this particular show. We also give you the newsletter. So, again, that's moneymanagementradio.com if you're so inclined. So, that's what's happening in the market. Summer is generally thought of as a time when the market can be quieter, as the traders on Wall Street, the famous traders on Wall Street, decide to go vacationing in the Hamptons. And I know I have another business, and it does slow down during the summer. I mean, people take vacations. It just slows. It's our slowest time. In my other particular businesses, not so in the financial business. Financial business kind of goes up, down, you know, it just goes all over the place. Especially when the market gets upset, then of course the phones really ring, both for all sorts of reasons, questions and things of this sort. So you can also send me an email through the program director at your station about general market conditions, and I'll answer every email that I get. But I don't answer specific recommendations on your specific situation or particular stock. I won't ever comment on anything like that. So at least in Nevada County, Northern California, it has been hot. There's no doubt about it. Been 90 to 100. And so, you know, what the markets will do, I don't think they're affected by the heat. But we are watching all the different various asset classes, the utilities, bonds, of course, which are IOUs. There's the tech sector and the emerging market sector, the domestic stocks. There's all sorts of different industries and even geographical areas that you can invest in through different vehicles, investment vehicles. And then, of course, one of the famous holdings, people don't really regard cash as an equity holding, but I do. I think cash is an equity holding. It's a strategic holding. And the reason I say that is because during the crisis of 08 and 09, it would be a strategic holding and probably beneficial to have held cash during that period. I saw a lot of people whose portfolios got fairly well hammered during the crisis of 08 and 09. But, and a lot of people said, I don't want to open up my statement. It's depressing. But I never knew of anyone that was afraid to open a savings account statement. And why was that? Because it didn't go anywhere with the little bit of interest you got, but it really didn't go anywhere. So if somebody had all their money in CDs or in cash as a strategic holding, they said, okay, I'm afraid of the markets. I'm going to hold cash in CDs. The benefit there was no loss of principal, right? No downside risk. Now, I suppose if you're holding savings accounts or cash in a U.S. bank and you hold a U.S. dollar, there could be what we call currency risk. Right? Let's say you have investor A and investor B. Investor A holds money in Swiss francs and investor B holds money in euros. And let's say we add an investor, investor C holds money in US dollars. Well, those three accounts will move slightly against each other as the currencies fluctuate because currencies, although used to be measured in gold, they are now measured for the most part against each other. So if one currency rises, the other currency may fall as far as its retail purchasing value, also depending on where you're going to do the purchasing. So cash is a strategic position, and I've always said there is a time to own an asset, and there is a time not to. And I specifically, myself, my opinion is this long-term buy and hold strategy is flawed, in my opinion. So I do believe there's a time to hold an asset and a time not to. I know a lot of people might disagree on the long-term hold strategy, but that's the way I believe. Now, Warren Buffett, arguably one of the most famous investors of our time, Warren Buffett. He's the CEO of a company called Berkshire Hathaway. He's often referred to as the Oracle of Omaha or the Sage of Omaha. And that refers to his place of birth and his residency. Warren Buffett holds the honor of being one of the top five richest men on the globe, according to Forbes, with an estimated net worth of $73 billion. Whoa. His first company was not called Berkshire Hathaway. It was the Buffett Partnership. And he established that way back when, with his lifelong partner, a gentleman by the name of Charlie Munger. That Buffett partnership eventually became the holding company Berkshire Hathaway, which does trade on the stock market. They have two classes of stock, I believe. And Berkshire Hathaway was named after a textile company that they bought as one of their first acquisitions. They bought a textile company, and the name was Berkshire Hathaway. Through the years, Berkshire Hathaway, under the control of Warren Buffett and his buddy, Charlie Munger, has made numerous acquisitions or investments. That's what they do. They either buy or invest in other companies, both large and small. Now, there are many household names under the Berkshire Hathaway lineup, whether they own it outright or just own a portion of it. Okay, they could own 5% of a company or 2.5, or they could own it all. The lineup is impressive of the companies they hold. I can't give them to you here. You can find them on Wikipedia, of course. I Googled up the list of assets owned by Berkshire Hathaway, and you will be amazed about how many companies these guys have ownership of or a piece of. So Berkshire Hathaway, just Google up list of assets owned, and you'll see a lot of names that you are very, very familiar with. With a long and successful history, and many proverbial irons in the fire. When you have a public company, you have a shareholder meeting, okay? And the shareholder meetings of Berkshire Hathaway have become quite the media event. It's a spectacle. Every year, they pack a venue with literally thousands of spectators. Also, shareholders and news media. Now, the shareholders get a ticket, but I believe they're allocated up to four tickets. And if they don't want to go, they don't have four people they want to go, they can offer them, and I've seen them on eBay. In 2015, it was estimated over 40,000 people attended this event. 40,000. You got to put them in a stadium like Billy Graham. Mr. Buffett and Mr. Munger have a habit of staying, believe it or not, from 3 to 5 hours in their little chairs on the stage. And a microphone goes around, and they answer the hundreds of questions put to them at the meeting by the shareholders and even the spectators. They're obviously held in extremely large venues to accommodate. I mean, where do you sit 40,000 people, right? Not at your local multi-use room in your high school, for sure. There's always a lot of one-liners and quips that are muttered by these two VPs. I find Mr. Munger and Mr. Buffett both uttering extremely intuitive one-liners, and some of them are comedic, some of them are thought-provoking, and their personalities perk forth in these meetings for all to see. They're up there in age, too. I don't know. I think Warren's in the 80s. I don't know. He's up there. And there's a whole list of notable quips from Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. I've got a few here. And they are, and you can find these again on Google or your favorite web browser. Risk comes from not knowing what you're doing. I like that one. I might disagree a little bit. You can know what you're doing and still have a risk, but that's what they said. Risk comes from not knowing what you're doing. Then they have the proverbial rule one. These I do believe in. Rule one, don't lose money. Rule two, don't forget rule number one. That's a good point, right? Because if you're losing money in your investments, you're not going forward. Now, albeit I'm sure everybody sees red in their portfolio from time to time. It's inevitable, you know, when markets go down, there's a good chance you're going to see red. Now, when markets do go down, there are things that have a tendency to rise, too. So I suppose if you were all-knowing, you could trade to show profit every single day, if you were all-knowing. But nobody is, right? We need a crystal ball. So I guess if we had one wish on our crystal ball, I'd say, let me know what the stock market's going to do and all the stocks in it tomorrow. And then you could just bet that way, knowing it was going to happen. But nobody really knows. So losing money, if you're losing money, you want to try to keep that to a minimum. You want to kind of keep your losses to a minimum. If you're going to be in the market, you are there for the potential to make money. By assuming that potential, you also assume the risk of losing money. Now, there are certain products out there that do have a guaranteed rate of return and a guaranteed participation rate, but those are usually not federally guaranteed, and those are specific products that have many, many hooks and crannies in them, like prepayment penalties and early withdrawal penalties. So there are ways to do it, but they are very, very special types of investments, and they are not really risk-free because you're at risk of the company issuing that particular guarantee going under, right? Guarantee is only as good as the people making the guarantee. But normally, the general rules that if you're investing and you're not in, in the bank in a savings account, and you've accepted the potential of making money, you have to accept the risk of losing it, some of it. So the trick is when the markets turn red, you have to minimize the losses. And when markets run, you want to participate more in the rising market. If one says, well, I want to participate and follow the market exactly, well, if the market goes up 30%, then you'd make 30%. But if the market falls 30%, you'd lose 30%. In my opinion, that's a little bit too risky. So I think a better strategy would be to try to limit your losses, but to participate in some gains when they're there. Warren Buffett also said, only when the tide goes out do you discover who's swimming naked. My take on that is he's talking about who's leveraged, who owes a lot of money. It looks like they're solvent, looks like they're doing well, but when the economic storms come and there's duress in the financial markets, the ones that owe a lot of money or extremely high leverage get into trouble quick. So when the tide goes out, you can see somebody's dangling or whatever it is. And only when the tide goes out do you discover who's swimming naked. That's true, and in investing as well. Here's another one which I thought was really, really enlightening. It's something really I chewed on for a long time. He said, it takes 20 years to build a reputation and five minutes to ruin it. Think about that. It takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it. And that is probably true in everything. You know, you could have a great driving record for 20 years, and 5 minutes you can completely blow it out of the water. So be it with investment and also your personal reputation. Everything really applies to that. It takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it. There are many, many more enlightening insights. I can't read them all, but you can see some of these. I found them at brainyquote.com, but I'm sure if you just searched under Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger's favorite quotes and quips, you could find them. Warren Buffett still lives in a modest house in central Omaha, the one that he bought in 1958 for $31,000. He still lives there. Now he's made some expansions and he owns some other properties that he may live in from time to time. But his primary residence is this Omaha house that he bought for $31,000. Labeled by many a modest man by several measures, not all obviously, at $73 billion net worth. I wouldn't say he's modest. I guess modest doesn't refer to your net worth. It refers to your exhibition of it, right? If you're modest, you cover yourself up at a pool party. You're modest. He's thought by many to be modest. He continues to capture the minds, hearts, and imaginations of many, including shareholders, competitors of his, the media. He's just a real figure, and he is what I call an earth mover. Despite running a company currently valued at almost $500 billion, Buffett and his partner Charlie Munger only pay themselves an annual salary of $100,000. Flat fee, $100,000. Now, I guess if you're worth $73 billion, you could pay yourself nothing. But I know a lot of companies that make a lot of money and pay their CEOs millions of dollars, millions. So you're listening to Money Matters on community radio station. This thought was an interesting time to take a look at Warren Buffett. We'll be right back after this brief musical interlude. You're listening to Money Matters on a community radio station. My name's Mark.
On my toes.
All right. Warrant. So you're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. How is everybody today? I'm really glad to be here and doing the show for everyone. Yeah, the market's checking in on the Dow. Dow down now 153. So we'll see where that goes. I had an interesting experience. You know, I switched insurance companies, medical insurance. You know, I have to buy insurance company, federal law, and I have an insurance company anyway, health insurance. California, we have to buy it from a specific company if you're buying regular insurance company. But I bought into another type of insurance company called a fraternal. I won't go into fraternals. Maybe at some point I will, but it's a different insurance company. And with the way the fraternal works, at least in this one particular aspect, is the fraternal is a reimbursement type of company. So the original insurance companies for health insurance were reimbursement. You paid the bill, you sent it, and they give you a check. Health maintenance organizations, now you prepay for services, and then the bill goes to them. So the provider has to bill the insurance company. So on my fraternal now, it's a reimbursement. So I pay the bill, and I submit it to the insurance company. So the first thing you do on my particular insurance company, a fraternal, is you go to the facility and you say, I'm going to pay cash. Now, I found 5 or 6 years ago it was hard to pay cash. You know, doctors only really, I guess you could pay cash, but anytime I asked, they always wanted insurance. It was kind of weird. Like, how much was it? I don't know. Nobody ever pays cash. Well, nowadays, because insurance is getting expensive and there's Obamacare and all sorts of, you know, things going on with health insurance, now doctors do take cash and so do hospitals. And so I had an interesting experiment, an interesting event that happened. I had to go to my local hospital to get a rather involved medical test. I'm okay. Nothing's wrong with me. That we know. So because I go to the hospital now with my new insurance company, I have to pay cash. So I go to them and I say, I got to pay cash. I want to pay cash. I want to pay for cash. And the hospital, like many of the doctors I run into, say, oh, okay, we have cash price and insurance price. Oh, cash discount. Okay. So on this recent visit to the hospital, I had a fairly expensive, significant cost to this test. And this was going to be a good example of what the difference was between paying cash and having the hospital bill the insurance company. I told the hospital when I arrived, I said, I have a type of insurance where I pay cash, and just give me a receipt with the medical codes on it, and I will submit it to the insurance company myself. Now, that immediately relieves the hospital of dealing with your insurance company. They just get paid right before they give the service. They don't have to wait or nothing. Bang, give them a check. This is regarded by the hospital as what it is, a cash payment collected at time of visit, no waiting. You could say it's COD, cash on delivery, right? In fact, this was probably prepaid NAD, which means I paid it a half hour before I had the diagnosis and had the specific test. The cost to me for this test, paying cash, was $1,780. Ouch. Now, it was interesting what kind of test it was. Now, I just want you to think about this, okay? My test that they had me do was what they call a stress test echocardiogram. I think I got that name right. And it entailed this. Go in, check in the hospital, and I said, I'm paying cash. So they said, pay $780. And so I go in, and they have me take my shirt off, and they put a bunch of heart discs, glue them to your chest, maybe 15 of them. And then you see all these little moving arms on the chart, like a lie detector test, but it's picking up electrical signals from my chest cavity. Then they laid me down on a table, and they used a device similar to what I thought looked like a sonogram for a baby. Okay, they sonogram your heart and they take some photographs and they look at it pumping while you're at rest. Okay, so all I had, they put these little discs on me, took about 5 minutes, and they laid me down and did the sonogram that took about another 5 minutes. So I was in there about 10 minutes. Then the cardiologist comes in. The heart specialist. She comes in and they immediately put me on a treadmill. And they start the treadmill and start inclining the angle of the treadmill. And I got up to 12 minutes, which is close to their max. They told me for firemen they got to go to 15, but they had to run me to 12 to get me up to the maximum heart rate of about 145 or 50. Then when you're huffing and puffing, the cardiologist is watching you and watching the monitors, make sure you don't have a heart attack and glack out right there on the table, which they said they have had, you know, issues when people get on those things. But I didn't have any issue. In fact, they had a hard time getting my heart up, and they finally got it up. And then when you're puffing and huffing and your heart's beating crazy, they run you over to the table, they lay you down, and they take another sonogram, and they look at it while the heart is beating 150 strokes a minute. And then the cardiologist looks at it, and she talks to you for 5 minutes, and then she leaves. So she comes in, get on the treadmill, spend 12 minutes, sonogram takes five. She talks to me for 10. She's there a total of, what, 25 minutes. And the tech is there an extra 10 minutes, and that's it. That's all they do, and then they print out a computerized report. For that, $1,780, and they told me that did not include the charge from the cardiologist. I went, what? So I was there actively doing the test in front of the cardiologist for about 25 minutes. $1,780. I asked, how much would it be if I was to pay by insurance and have you bill the insurance? $2,620. $2,620. Now, we will do the advanced math. I was told there would be no advanced math today, and I'm telling you there's no advanced math, so I will do the math. And the math is $840 difference. It's almost a third higher if you go have them bill your insurance company. You then ask the question, as I did, what is it about getting paid by an insurance company versus cash that requires a hospital to charge a third more? Well, we dissect what the reasons might be. Having to wait for payment, right? The hospital has to wait for a payment when they bill the insurance company. So they lose the opportunity cost of having the money while they wait for the insurance company. Opportunity cost is you don't have the $2,600, so you wait. So what could you earn on that $2,600 while you wait if you had it at a normal rate of return? Yeah, but that's an opportunity cost. If I had money and I put it in the bank, what would I earn? Well, the opportunity cost on having $2,600, depending on how long you wait, is probably a few bucks. I assumed a rate of return of 10%, which you tell me where you can get 10% anywhere, right? And a guarantee you can't, as far as I know. So I assume 10%, which is really high. I assume that the hospital would have to wait 90 days to get its money. So it would lose $2,600 worth of interest at 10% came out to less than $100. Okay, that's how much money they would lose on the opportunity cost. If they had the money and have to wait for insurance, they lose $100 in income. Okay. So since the difference was $840, they lost $100 in the opportunity cost. Now they've got $740, which they still charged. Why? Now the question boggled my mind. What else could cost the hospital $740? Shipping and handling of the money? Well, shipping and handling of the paperwork, that's a different deal. Since we already figured the opportunity cost, I thought, well, okay, the paperwork. There's going to be a lot of paperwork dealing with insurance company. I call it shipping and handling. I asked myself, how involved and costly is that entire process for the hospital to deal with an insurance company? Well, obviously, a lot. $740 for one file, right? My bill costs them $740. Well, let's continue on. Obviously, when they give me a receipt with a code on it, it's pretty easy. Stress test echocardiogram, Mark Cunaberty address. Here's the receipt. $1,780 and paid. However, when they deal with insurance company, of course, then they submit that. Now, I don't know what the required paperwork is to submit a test to the insurance company. The submittal process is probably, by the money they're charging, probably fairly involved, right? And then I thought, well, maybe there's a kickback rate, not a kickback as in paying somebody back money, but a kickback where they submit the application to get paid. And the insurance company comes back and says, we need more information. Now, the old adage that a buddy once told me was an insurance company's secret mission is to keep the money as long as they can. So if you ever made a claim on an insurance company, my buddy says, oh, yeah, they play games with you to try to keep the money as long as they can. That's an opinion. That's an opinion only. I can imagine that there are many landmines in the paper trail of submitting a claim to an insurance company, especially if you have an inexperienced clerical worker, if they don't cross all the T's and dot all the I's, right? She might have missed something. And there are many insurance companies out there, so each insurance company must have their own form, right? Even experienced clerical managers can make mistakes on a pile of forms, which is probably required during a claim submittal. Resubmitting a claim is probably required at a certain point. And every box that you leave unchecked on the required form that requires to be checked means a longer wait for the hospital while the paperwork goes back and forth. So I said it might take 90 days. Maybe it takes longer. I don't know. Of course, then I thought, well, there might be legal issues too. What happens if there's a legal problem? You know, the hospital can't recoup its loss of insurance company for whatever reason. If the claim was denied or the loss was incurred, the hospital will have to pay that out of its pocket until they pursue you to pay the bill that was not paid by the insurance company. So there's got to be legal cost. So that must occur at a certain rate, right? They already know, well, hey, 1 out of 10 insurance claims will be denied, or 1 out of 100. Whatever it is, they've got that actuarial figure down pat. They have to. They got to know what to charge and what it costs to deal with an insurance company. So that cost of possible kickback, possible incomplete paperwork, denial of claim, or legal assistance required to pursue. The hospital probably presumes a certain rate of that, a certain amount that it's going to cost them every year. And that is built into the rate of the insurance, the extra money they charge for insurance. I sat over a cup of coffee and I thought, man, the possibilities of what could go wrong when transmitting and transacting complicated medical procedures on paperwork to an insurance company whose game is to possibly keep the money as long as possible, I could really sit there for hours thinking, wow, this could go wrong, that could go wrong, this could go wrong. And I'm sure that the hospital clerical workers and the people that do the accounting and the submittals, they probably have a whole department to deal with insurance. I'm sure they know exactly what it costs them. They've got it down to the penny. And I basically gave up after compiling quite a list of things that could go wrong when dealing with a profit-driven insurance conglomerate, and trying to get them to cut you a check, trying to get the hospital a check. Never mind the government requirements heaped on the poor souls processing when dealing with a national health care, let's say Obamacare, Medicare, Medi-Cal, or other government entity. Can you imagine? Holy mackerel, I think the spec's on a hammer. Government spec on a hammer's got to be a couple of pages long. I mean, how difficult could it be to spec out requirements for a hammer? Can you imagine somebody comes in with a stress test echocardiogram, all the things that have to be filled out? And then if you've got to deal with the government entity, holy macro, that takes weeks. Maybe my 90 days waiting period is an underestimation. After an hour or two of thinking of all the things that could go wrong, and probably do go wrong on occasion, that could befall a processing hospital or even a small doctor's office that has to do the same thing if he treats you in the office, it's actually surprising that maybe a 30% surcharge covers it. Maybe it should be more. And that is one reason why your medical costs are skyrocketing. You're listening to Money Matters on your community's the radio station. We'll be right back.
We can look that guy right in the eye. We're in the
And you're tuned to your community radio station, Money Matters. My name is Mark Cunaberti. Thanks for joining us on the economic show, Money Matters. This is show 254 shows, entitled Decisions. So the markets go up and the markets go down, right? One expert says we're in the midst of a strong recovery, while another expert says we are days away from financial Armageddon. Who's right, and why is there always so much disagreement? It's human nature to disagree, and with each opinion on the market, yet comes another, right? You've all seen opinion after opinion. The real question that I find most investors are concerned with is not if there's a recovery or not. They just want to know which way the markets will go. Is my stocks going to go up, or my stocks going to go down? For only in an up market do most investors make money. We could be in a recovery, yet the markets could plummet, and most investors might lose money. Or we could be headed straight off a financial cliff in the economy and the markets could still be rallying. The truth lies in the fact that most investors only really want to know if I'm going to make any money or not. Will my stocks go up in value? I've always said the stock markets of the world reflect reality eventually, but that their day-to-day movements are only a result of perception of all the millions of players in it on any given day and any given moment. Now, let's take an example. The housing market started to turn down some way in the late 2007. But housing stocks were still going up. Most investors didn't either believe that housing could correct or they didn't see it. And they were buying housing stocks right up until we were kind of in the middle of the housing correction. The perception as these housing stocks rose was that the real estate market was fine, even though the housing statistics were starting to turn negative. Housing stocks eventually reflected the reality of the bust and subsequently crashed and burned. One could draw the conclusion, therefore, that the perception first kept housing stocks up, then reality brought them down. With that in mind, how do we know how much the markets of today are reflecting reality or just mirroring investor perception? I like to parallel markets and economics with your personal finances on another example. By drawing a certain comparison to our daily financial experiences, we might better be able to correctly assess the macroeconomic picture in stock markets and give us clues as to where we're actually headed. Think of it this way. Imagine you have a neighbor, he's got new cars in his driveway and seemed to go on vacation every month. He had his kitchen remodeled and he wore the best clothes. Now, would you assume he was wealthy? Or would part of you wonder whether he was just up to his eyeballs in debt? Your perception of how much money he had might be quite different than the actual financial reality. And indeed, during 08 and 09, I play golf on occasion and going up and down these golf courses, seeing these amazing houses during the crisis, I saw a lot of them were before closure. Now, prior to the crisis, I would be driving by these houses or driving in my golf cart and I would say, wow, look, that guy must have a lot of money. He's got a great house on a golf course. No. Crisis hit and bang, his house went into foreclosure. He didn't even have enough money in back of him to sell his house. He just let it go. So I would ask you, fast forward to what you think you know is the degree of consumer and government debt that exists today. In other words, how much do you think you know about the degree of consumer and government debt that is out there today? Do you think there's a lot of debt out there today? Does the government owe a lot? Does the consumer owe a lot? Do you owe a lot? What conclusions might you draw as to how healthy our economy really is? What do you think? Are we running on the fumes of excessive debt? Or is the economic engine of America firing on all cylinders? Is the stock market running on perception of what people think? Or is it running on the reality of a healthy economy? Answering these questions might make us 1 foot closer, might be able to make us 1 step closer, get us closer to truthfully assessing the financial health of our economy and not being taken in by just the perception of the day-to-day movements. Answer these questions and we may have a better indication which way the market will go in the near and far future. It's that simple, folks. We'll be right back to wrap up the show.
At least until I die. Damn if you do, damn. cause I'm working for a living. Hey, I'm not complaining cause I really need to work, but hitting up my buddies got me feeling like a jerk. $100 condo, 200 red, I get a check on Friday, but it's already spent. Working for a living. Working, working for a living. Cause I'm working for a living.
And welcome back. My name is Mark Cuniberti, hosting the Financial Economic Forum entitled Money Matters, carried on dozens of radio stations throughout the greater United States, with newscasts going out weekly. And you can hear past shows at moneymanagementradio.com and send an email to your program director at the station where you're hearing the show. Today's show is 254, entitled Decisions, Decisions. So it was a pleasure. The Dow is down 151 as of today, July 6, 2017, about ready to close up the markets. Please remember that discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed are my opinions only, or the opinions of anyone I may have interviewed or any articles I've read or I might have read. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff members, or underwriters. My name is Mark. God bless. Have a great day.